broadcast, and that should be us hopefully live now if things are working.
Good evening, everybody. This is David Noel in Dalgety Bay in Fife, and as ever, joined from over in Glasgow by John Johnson, my co-host. Tonight on Radio Edutalk, we're delighted to be joined by Professor Stephen Heppel, who I believe is en route, possibly in a platform or the side of a railway somewhere en route in the centre of England. How are you this evening, Stephen?
Well, I'm actually on the platform at Royston, which is slightly the back of beyond, really. I hope there's nobody there. I've got family in Royston, but I jumped off the train because the signal was so bad, and it turns out to be a bit of a one-horse town, really. But it's a lovely evening, and there's no rain, and so it's all pretty good.
Thank you. Fantastic. And I believe there might be a wee interruption in a few moments when you embark on the next leg of your journey, but hopefully you'll be able to stay with us, and we'll appreciate that the signal might drop at some point during tonight's show. What we'll do
it's a nice queue, actually, because the train that I was going to get back on has been cancelled, so I'm sitting here having to sort of build a bit of a plan B. And actually, that leads me probably to the most important part of all this anyway, which is that I think the world the kids are going out into is a world that's full of the most unexpected stuff. You know, they're never any more able to anticipate everything that's going to happen because, hey, put us in a world full of surprises. And I think that's really significant in terms of designing learning and learning spaces because, you know, in the last century, we built this is full of certainty. You came in, you sat at the same desk, facing the direction, listened to the same teacher. The teacher was probably wearing the same jacket, you know, on the same time, table on the Monday, you know. And all that queued people up for was a world of certainty. I think this millennium is a world where that certainty's gone, you know. I think technology has taken us a little closer to the age, and so when things go wrong, they go spectacularly wrong. And as a result, I think we're looking for schools and learning spaces and curricula and pedagogies that actually take kids by surprise and leave them able to come up with a good plan B. So, you know, the problem I'm facing, if having jumped out of a train, they've been the timetable, so how am I going to get the hole from here, is the sort of daily problem that face kids around the world. And I think we need a new sort of education to cope with that. We need an education that challenges and astonishes kids rather than one that comforts them and gives them certainty. So it's a very interesting time, I think, not just on this platform, but globally as well.
A fantastic way to link into tonight's show, Stephen. We're hoping that there'll be some listeners to the live stream tonight, and if you have a comment or a question for Professor Stephen Heppel, we're going to be talking about his current work and thinking, and I know that Professor Heppel's been travelling extensively and will continue to do over the summer months, so it's going to be fascinating to hear what you've been up to. If you'd like to get in touch, then you can email Radio Edutalk. The email address is edutalker, edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, if you just put your comment or question, and then edutalk, edutalk. Stephen, you're just back from Australia, and can you tell us a wee bit about your work out there recently?
Yeah, well, I've been out. I mean, I go out there. I spend about 2 months a year in Australia. I mean, several things to note about Australia. And dear old Kevin Rudd, when he was Prime Minister, he faced the recession by throwing money at learning, and every school out there has a BER, a bird building. Which is a special building that they were given. It's a large building that they configured any which way they like. They're in some of the built libraries, some are built gymnasiums. But if I tell the listeners that BER stands for Building the Educational Revolution, these are the words you want to hear from your ministers, aren't they? It wasn't building a bit of capacity or, you know, buying our way out of recession. It was using the recession opportunity to transform learning. And by the way, every secondary kid got a laptop, an iPad or tablet of choice. And by the way, through the National Broadband Network, which I'm educational lead for over there, through the NBN as well. So, you know, this has been quite fun, but far, but it's a very broad-based connectivity. And of course, those little spaces, really exciting for me, because a lot of them listen to, you know, some of the things I'm doing elsewhere in the world. So the people have built agile spaces with, you know, breakout rooms, and you know the rule of three for third millennial spaces is you never have more than three walls, and you don't have less than, and don't have fewer than 3 points of focus. And you're able to contain three different activities in the space at once. And those three things, that rule of three for third millennial spaces, they've really adhered to pretty well out there. So you've got the super classes with kids being taught in, you know, I mean, groups of 80 and 90 children with a gang of teachers. And of course, no surprise, it turned out that their teachers in parallel, specializing, you know, somebody narrating the lesson, somebody looking after the kids in the start, somebody doing the differentiation, the stretching and broadening. You know, three teachers in parallel, the whole class goes way faster than they ever did with one teacher in series with smaller numbers. So, you know, I come from advocating the small classes, which I was a great fan of when I was a teacher. You know, I thought like 18 would be a maximum. And I'm just exhilarated by how fast and how peaceful and how studious and how actually college-like these large classes are. I was in a glorious class in Holy Rosary School in Tasmania just the other day. The teachers were all wearing coloured, you know, hats. They got crash hats on, like Bob the Builder. And, you know, and the red hat and the yellow hat and the blue hat, so the kids know who's in which role. So if they get stuck, they're looking for the person in the blue hat. Like if you get stuck on the N8, you know, you're looking for an RAC van to sort of pull over and fix your problems. And, you know, they're doing practical maths. They're all building a cardboard town. All the kids are doing estimating and measuring and construction stuff. And the whole thing is probably genuinely exhilarating. It just worked really well. And it's exciting to see, you know. And what you see when you walk in the room, it appears like chaos. The kids all over the place. It's astonishingly quiet for the numbers. You can't help but reflect, wow, this is pretty silent, you know. And the silence itself is quite seductive. But the kid came running over to me and just said, he said, oh, I love these days. I love these days. Well, when you walk in a classroom and the first thing a kid says is, I'm loving this, you know that things are going pretty well, don't you, really? So I'm excited about what's happening there. And I've got a quite an interesting project just shaping up in Tasmania, where what we're trying to do is to see if we can prove that very small rural schools can run as cheaply per head as big urban ones. And my belief is they can, but you have to harness the local community as well. And I was really excited in a school, which was pretty cool, down in down on the coast of Tasmania, where the boat building was going bankrupt, and that was the core of the town. So the school had taken over boat building by putting it on the curriculum, which was nice. and then the boat building was now being run by grandparents, grandmothers mostly. So you've got grannies building boats, boat building's on the curriculum, the town's industry's been saved, the kids are all learning the skills that are necessary to work in the town, and everybody's having the most brilliant time. I mean, it was just lovely to see, you know. So I think, and by the way, if that works, we're going to build a little tiny rural school in the middle of the town to show that they'll work in urban spaces as well with that same community support from the grannies and everybody else. So there's some really cool stuff going on out there, and some quite good indigenous stuff I'm involved with down in the west of Australia and Perth as well. So short version is, they are building their education revolution, and they're storming in. Look, one of the little things I noticed, which was perhaps a surprise for some of your listeners, was that, you know, when kids were working with laptops traditionally, you know, a kid would flip open the sort of screen of their laptop, and then they'd be behind it. We had those very one-to-one applications where, you know, one kid was sitting using one laptop on the road. But I like a world where kids collaborate and share and exchange. And it's really noticeable, I think, now that kids are very comfortable with putting a laptop down on the table in front of them, you know, and sharing what's going on there. You see kids sitting north, south, east, and west around, say, an iPad, you know, just rocking it slightly towards each other so that they have the direct focus of the screen. And there's something about the phrase multi-touch that means multi-use too. I've seen really good collaboration. Whereas, you know, you look and see a couple of kids sharing a laptop, one of the kids is driving the laptop and the other kid's watching. So I think we're seeing better collaboration with the new tablets that are coming out than we ever saw with laptops. And because you see that in spades in Australia, because they've all been given one by the government as their way of buying them out of recession. So it's a pretty exciting place at the moment. And on Sunday, I'm off to Barcelona, but perhaps we'll talk about that in a moment or two.
Thanks, Stephen. This is John Johnson here. I'm really interested in a couple of things, well, most of the things you're saying there. One was that you're talking about all the one-to-one stuff that's going on. Is that, can you tell us how widespread that is in Australia?
Well, it's the whole, I mean, that whole debate, I think, is charged with excitement at the moment, because stuff's moving so fast. You know, the technologies are changing so quickly, and that itself is pretty interesting. I mean, you know, we're moving quickly, I think, away from you know, the computer, something that sat on the desktop, something that was in the briefcase, something that you're probably going to wear, and you know, is built into your contact lenses or whatever. But I think we've just got to the point when we're saying to kids, I'll tell you what, bring a browser. You know, when you come into school, have some sort of browser. And I've got a project in Denmark, which is very exciting. We're helping make over. We've got a prototyping sort of experiment in all the schools around Silkeborg, around the Lego factory. And each one of them is doing something quite radical with the space around their school, you know, putting up QR codes in the forest and a little sort of augmented reality signs on the trees and so on. It's all pretty exciting stuff. But one of the things that you really notice there, because Denmark's, I think, been at the forefront of making sure all the kids have got their phones turned on and out and on their desk. You know, the rule if you're using phones in the classroom is always, you know, phones on the desk, screen up, and you put them on the desk as soon as you come in the room. So the teacher looks around the room, you can see where the phones are, you can see which ones are active. And which ones aren't. So that works really well. But I don't think I've been in a school yet, but they've got a class set of mobile phones where, you know, the school's provided the mobile phones, all bought and paid for and connected with a SIM card in. I think I've seen lots of one-to-one iPads and one-to-one iPod Touches and one-to-one, you know, BlackBerry Playpads and so on. But I haven't seen a one-to-one mobile phone because the kids own them, not the school. So I think we're at that really clear line in the sand where going forward from here a lot of this is about the student's ownership. Mm. You know, if you say to the kids, I want you to get to school, and if they turn up with their bike and they've got a puncture, you don't send for the school bike technician to fix it. You know, you just tell them to sort it out before tomorrow. You know, and if their mum arrives and they put petrol in the diesel car, you know, you don't sort of send out the car technician. You just tell them to sort it out and don't be late again. You know, so I think we're moving technology away from being institutional towards being personal, in the way that actually we move cars. You know, it wasn't so long ago every company in any Scottish city would have had a company car pool, and they'd had a man who looked after it. Maybe we would have had the Morris Marina, because Marina was a pool car, you know, and so on, and you had a fleet. So all the metaphors were about boats, you know. And now nobody has a company pool anymore. They just tell you to turn up and buy the right car and make sure you're there on time. So I think the same thing's happening with technology in schools. And that's a very interesting change. So, you know, that means we've gone from being a one-to-one, knowing what everybody's got, to being, you know, a quite diverse thing. And the school needs to intervene for the bits the kids aren't going to bring through the door, which is the ruggedized laptops for PE and the big screens for music tech and school radio stations and so on. Because the kids aren't going to walk through the door with those in their backpacks. On the other hand, they've all got a good browser. And I think the smart schools are just creating a page on the web and saying, look, run this page, and it's a good test. You know, if you've got a device where everything on this page works, then you've got a device you can use in our schools to bring it in. You know? And it doesn't matter whether it's a smart phone or a pocket pad or a laptop. Or, you know, when you say to the kids, I'll tell you what, you know, if I was going to mug you in the street, which would be the device you'd hide in your pants, you know. You know, some of them will say, oh, I'll keep the phone. Some will say, I'll keep the laptop. And a few will say, actually, I don't care about the portable stuff. It's a big setup I've got. You know, I'm doing all this media stuff, and I need green screens and lots of, you know, they'll all have a different answer. Personally, I mean, we've gone a long way with personalization, and it seems to me we just forgot to be anything like as personalized as we should have been with school technology, and actually with furniture as well. You know, it seems bizarre, doesn't it? We've gone such a long way with personalization, and we understand that kids have got different predispositions and different, you know, and some would say they've got different learning skills. So, but then we gave them all identical chairs and identical laptops. It seemed silly, didn't it, really?
Yeah, I just totally agree, except I think maybe the pace in our local authorities, I know where I work now in North Lanarkshire, we've got, I think, three very short-term one-to-one iPad projects, but we're not at the stage where we're looking, except in our dreams, perhaps, at bring-your-own device. But one of the things you were saying about the ability to collaborate. I was in a primary five, like a 9-year-old's class today, where they're doing one-to-one iPads. And what the first thing I noticed as I walked in the door is how many of the children were looking at somebody else's device. And they were moving back and forwards and doing bits and pieces there. And I think that it's going to be a really powerful thing. If we can find a way, I think in Scotland, where we can pay for that, and who pays for it, and we can get it so that the people that run our networks are happy with the devices we put on them, you know?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the network thing is interesting because, you know, back in the era of blocking, you know, we was trying to keep the kids away from YouTube and keep them away from Twitter, and honestly, the best history teaching I've seen in the last year has been, you know, without an exception, I think, has been in Twitter, you know, where people are, you know, tweeting the sort of day in the life of historical characters, with somebody tweeting a great grandfather's diary from the Great War, you know, and it's sort of daily quests for better boots and dry boots and so on, you know.
Yeah.
And it was all pretty entertaining stuff, you know.
It's the challenges. How
so,
get
you know, I, you know, now we want them to be out there and in everything they can be in. You know, any which way of being and using whatever equipment they've got seems like a way forward. I think, you know, the locking and blocking era, I think, is, you know, with a moment of perhaps extreme caution, but it's certainly over. I think looking around the world, it's certainly going.
Yeah, I think it's, well, just from what I'm seeing locally in Scotland, we've got a huge diversity of the amount of blocking and bits and pieces that are going on, and obviously quite a lot of us, our vision is this idea of free access and an open network, but it's not become reality yet, and perhaps the people who need to give us permission.
It takes a while.
Yeah.
It takes a while for everybody to get on board, a bit like this train, actually, you know. and probably we don't need to wait for anyone, you know, and that's perfectly fine. But I do think there's a very clear direction, and also there are so many schools now. Really, I mean, people are reporting quite sensibly that, you know, when they had locking up, the kids were despairing because when things did go wrong online, the school said, "Well, you know, we don't do Facebook. It's nothing to do with us," you know. And when schools then embrace Facebook, which is a great tool in the classroom, you know, and start using it, you know, you get a little spike of the reporting because kids, oh, thank goodness, so now somebody I can talk to about all this because it's something we use in school now. And then those abuses just disappear, you know. I mean, not completely, of course, the kids are naughty, you know, but they drop dramatically. And you realise that in the locking and blocking schools, you know, they were doing the kids a real disservice, and they were leaving kids completely exposed, and things were genuinely problematic. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a challenge, really.
Stephen,
hang on, I've just got a message coming through on my phone, or somewhere I'm supposed to be standing. keep talk for a minute. I'm just going to have a moment of. of working out what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, what we'll do is just while we're waiting on Stephen to rejoin us, you're listening live to Radio Edutalk this Wednesday evening, and we're delighted to have on the show live from a train somewhere in central to north England, Professor Stephen Heppel. And if you would like to get in touch with Professor Heppel with a question or comment, then you can email us at edutalker, edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk. Or if you're on Twitter, if you just post your message on Twitter and include the hashtag Edutalk, EDUTALK, then John and I will be able to pick up your comment or question and pass it on to Professor Heppel before the end of the show. And please bear in mind that you can listen to a recording of tonight's programme. That will be up online, Edutalk.cc, within the next few hours or day or two. Stephen, are you back with us?
Yep, no, I'm back. I'm under the slightly incomprehensible destination board. So I can see where I'm going now. It all makes sense. I was on the wrong platform. No wonder the train hadn't arrived.
Stephen,
it's a funny thing, actually. This is all a bit... I mean, this is all... I think to school sometimes, they feel a bit as though they've kind of arrived at the platform slightly out of breath. And they can see that trains are going somewhere, and they recognise some of the faces on the train, but they're not sure whether to jump on, just go for it and trust the guys that are on the train because they know them, or whether they're going to sort of stand on the platform and wait for a bit more certain to get on the next train. I think where we are at the moment, the schools that have jumped on the train, they weren't sure where it's going, but it looked pretty exciting, are romping ahead of the schools that said, I'll tell you what, I'll just wait and get on the next one, you know. And, I think we have a big problem with the gaps opening up between, you know, the adopters and the slightly nervous lot. And I'm not sure how we're going to close that gap, because the one thing you see is spectacular. I mean, I'm tinkering resident in Mark Ollerton College in Adelaide and do a lot of work in South Australia. And I think we're on about week 56 of that new school being opened. And it's astonishing. You know, you walk into the school, and you would not believe what the school was like before they just rethought everything. They rethought the furniture, the layout, the organisation. This is a 2 to 18 school, so they go right through together. You know, they've got them in quite intimate sort of home bases. There's the geography of the school is sort of commons areas, a little breakout room is off them, so you can either do a big activity and then go off and specialise a bit like. When colleagues are at a conference, you know, that sort of plenary and then breakouts, or you can start in the breakouts and just spill into the plenary space when you want to just work in your own time. And all that seems to work astonishingly well. When you walk down the school, you think this is one of the best schools in Australia. The kids come running up to you and it's sweet, just keen, the faces are all smiling, you know, I mean, they're really loving their learning. 2 years ago, it wasn't quite the school from hell, but I'll tell you, it was a tough place. And I think what we're seeing is the schools that have got this right and are really going for it, they're accelerating so fast that the gap's really opening up in engagement terms between their children and other children. And that engagement is a secret weapon. You know, and I go into schools, you know, where they've got a sort of like 1 hour timetable and the kids sit on the, you know, they kind of sit there looking at the watch, and then 10 minutes before the end of the lesson, they think it's not really worth starting anything new because the girl's going to do anything. Then you go into other schools that are working on daytime table or half day timetable. The kids have got their heads down, and they say, you know, in their words, they say, you know, you can really get your head into something when you go for it over a half day. You know, when the bell keeps ringing, it's really hard to get any work done at all. When you've got a half day on it, a whole day on it, you can really show some stuff, and that sense of immersion is palpable. You know, you feel the engagement. I just worry that the gap that's opening up, which, you know, I mean, kids in primary school today are still going to be probably 150. So we've got about, you know, 18 years to queue them up for a century and a half of learning. And that's a tiny amount of time. And then if we don't get them moving quickly in the first 18 years, what hope have they got for the next century and a half? You know, if they like skiing, you know, when you watch people going on the downhill ski run. If you start quickly enough, you carry that speed right the way through the whole run, and you are a lot quicker. If you don't start quickly enough, you're always trying to catch up, and you just haven't got enough speed, and you just don't get there. And I think it's where we are with kids. And if you look at the pieces of data, actually quite interesting. You know, everybody talks about Finland being a wonderful country and they're excited, they're aspirational, and wish we were all like Finland. We can actually look at the data. Kids in Finland they get the best results in terms of science, for sure, but they're some of the least interested in science children on the planet. You know, the effect of them being, driven towards fairly dreary targets, to be honest. It's not about testing. The thing is, they don't do a lot of testing. It's not about the quality of their teaching, because then you've got, you know, their teachers are the most highly professional teachers in Europe. You know, if you can't get a job as a teacher, you fall back to second choice, which is being a doctor. It's not about that, but there's something about this very prescriptive focus on what must be learned that seems to just turn kids off science. So, you know, when you look at the piece of data, the kids who love science most to be the Mexicans, who don't know any science at all. You know, when you look at the graph that says how much science do you know, no, they don't know much, but I'll tell you what, they're absolutely loving it, you know. And those kids are going to carry on through the next 150 years of their lives loving science, whereas the Finnish kids have learned a lot of science, but they're never going to go back to it, never going to do it again. Well, it's a really interesting choice, isn't it, for Scotland. And I guess what you really want are kids who are good at science and love it. And, you know, in that quadrant of the graph, you know, high scores and high interest, really there's only Hong Kong. There's also no other countries at all. So it's kind of interesting to see people trading off excitement about performance and nobody trying to reach out and see if they can have both. And I think that's going to change. I think a few nations are going to get that right. They're going to get out there and join Hong Kong. Those are going to be the nations that dominate the next century.
Yeah, it's David Noble here again. I'm wondering, when you're talking about getting the learning spaces right and the technologies in place and bring your own device, etc. But I'm wondering, you know, you're working with many schools where there's a national curriculum in place. Does that mean that, you know, where they have that flexibility and there's engagement and such like, and these sound like fantastic learning environments and social spaces, but do you find that their adoption or embedding of the national curriculums in their various countries, is that quite messy? Does it sometimes not tie up with government expectations and maybe even expectations?
No, it's not really, because in truth, even the most successful government are hugely under-ambitious for their kids. You know, they look at the whole thing and they think, oh, children. And I think governments have got a sort of productivity model of this. Let's do what we used to do, but a little bit more of it. And Scottish teachers are as tired as everybody else's teachers in the productivity model. When you do it differently, you know, you don't just get 5% better or 2% better, or you're not just hanging on by your fingernails to last year's results. You get flipping stellar kids. You know, they're just, their performance is so much better. Of course they still deliver on the national curriculum. Of course they still deliver on literacy and numeracy. Of course they still still average. But also they're coming out, they're learning with a passion for it. And that's the absolute beauty of all this. The only way to do this is with the children. You cannot, I've said in conferences a thousand times, you can't build better learning for children. It's not possible. But you can build better learning with children. And, you know, when you ask them that question, and how might we make our learning better? And when you say to them, I'll tell you what, you know, you're not looking as excited by this as you should. What could we do better? And, you know, like in Loughborough College, you know, where Max Brzezinski, the deputy head, says to the kids, you know, when you see great learning happen, get your phone out and video it, and we'll build a scrapbook of what great learning looks like. So at that school, you know, if you see a kid pointing a phone at you and videoing your lesson, that's a flattering thing. You think, oh, gosh, you think it's really that good, you know. And they're working with the kids to build a scrapbook of what great learning looks like. And a lot of schools, most schools, you know, if you've got your phone out, started videoing a teacher, your parents will be in before the end of the day, you'd be in big trouble, you know. So listening to the authentic voice of learners, and that's an extreme case, but listening to the authentic voice gives you better things. I mean, I'm going to Spain on son became a professor in Madrid these days, as well as in England. We've got a project there with primary, we've got infant, junior, and secondary school kids, and they're redesigning their own learning spaces. And they've been doing the science of it so far. They've been running around with little decibel meters on their phones and measuring the lux levels and all those sort of things. And doing stop frame animation of the space. So they've really got their heads around knowing the space. And they've Skyped to other kids, they've Skyped to the daughter's Juliet's classroom in West London, which is stunning. It was designed by children for children, and their results have gone through the roof as a result of all that. And they're Skyping in for kids in Australia and Denmark and so on, and getting ideas. And now they're doing better learning, and because you get three things from that. But, even if they were daft as brushes and had no ideas at all, it's thinking about how might we learn better. It's that reflective practice that propels them. Just the minute you get them thinking, learning about learning, what is it they say in Singapore, Kenneth Chen, the education minister in Hong Kong would say that learning to learn is their primary focus now, and he advises people to move away from content delivery. Remember, Hong Kong, the only country out there in the Pacific quadrant that says, we're loving it and we're good at it. So, these kids in Spain, the first thing, if you can get them reflecting on their own practice, then that reflection propels them, is that meta-level metacognition, is that meta-level reflection that's so powerful. But the second thing is, they're not daft as brushes. They do have good ideas, and you can learn from their suggestions, which are really powerful. And then the third thing, of course, is they don't just watch the teachers teaching, they watch their own learning, and they feed back to each other. And those three things together, you get proper exciting learning from all that. And it's head and shoulders above what ministers would hope for. Ministers think, a little bit better, and I'm out of here, that would be good. Everybody would think, well enough, 10% improvement, But you can have 100% improvement. You can have flipping stellar kids if you just sit down and think about how might we do this better, from the ground up. And that's what people started to do, and I think that's that is building an education revolution. That's the phrase they use in Australia, and I think it's a global phrase now.
Yeah, and then the whole idea of getting your learners to video you when they think you're teaching well, so it's fantastic. The thing I'm thinking, there's a certain jump. I know when I was in the classroom, things that went really well were very often things that I took a chance on. But it's how do we sort of get to the point where all our a majority of our staff are ready to teach like that, and that's sort of dangerous to themselves, way or a way they perceive as dangerous to themselves. So
I think it's a good question, and I think one of the ways around that, most of the schools I'm working in, they have post sessions in the parents' evenings, so whenever the parents are in, they've got these posters up. It was just like a university conference where they're saying, we're really interested in boys' performance, and this is what we've learned from looking around what other schools have done. Our hypothesis is if we do this, it's going to improve, and we'd like a few parents to help us with that. And you get that sense when maybe you come through the door that there's active research going on about how we can make learning better. And you haven't got to do that for very long before they come through the door, and they would feel nervous if there wasn't anything going on. I'm old enough to remember teaching in the 70s, where pretty much every year, we did something different. And I think if we'd felt we hadn't tried something new and fresh and built on somebody else's ideas, we'd have thought we were, we'd done the kids a great disservice, really, by not offering them the new opportunities that were appearing all around. Well, I think we're back to that. But I think the big change here at this time is that parents really start to understand how good their kids might be, and they want better. And I think 10 years ago they were nervous. Oh, what are you doing with our kids? Are the guinea pigs? Now they can see how good their kids are, and they're saying, would you mind cracking on a bit, because my kids are running ahead of the school at the moment, and we wanted to catch up. Yeah. It's a really big change, and I think we ignore it at our peril.
Stephen, I'm wondering about maybe going back to technologies and education. I'm wondering about the trends that you're spotting. And what you've said earlier on in tonight's show, I'm wondering if there's a suggestion that, for example, we're moving in favour of tablets instead of, for example, smart tables. But That's maybe a kind of small example, but what trends are you seeing in terms of technologies and then pedagogies involving technologies?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's probably two parts to it. It's a simple answer and a hard answer. Let's do them both because we've got a little bit of time. Because, you know, I haven't got a train that's completely gone, so I may be here for the rest of the night. But the simple answer is that I think we're seeing diversity again. When all this kicked off, there was a lot of diversity. You know, we had people doing sort of prologue and Lisp, and we had them working on, you know, all sorts of different home computers, and we had and sort of Macintoshes and PCs and goodness knows what else, and CPM, goodness knows what sort of operating systems were there. And there was great diversity, and kids had the ability to sort of move from one computer to another. There's BBCB here and then something else there, and they could move from one to the other. There was this period of standardization of, you know, we're all going to do it the same way, use the same applications, all use Office or whatever. And that won't get you dull, you know, to be fair. And I don't know what we were thinking, really. But we seem to be moving back now to great diversity. And you've got exciting stuff. You've got kids doing cool stuff with games, consoles. You've got, tables and tablets. And you've got projectors. And you've got life-size art installations. And I think the common word here is creativity. I think we went from a period of uniformity. And there aren't jobs that are feeding upon kids, you know. If you turn up for a job and they say, what are you good at? And you can say, the one thing I'm really good at is I'm just like everybody else. You're not going to get employed. So, you know, now we're looking for kids that are ingenious and creative and got some imagination. And as I said at the beginning of this, you know, can cope with the unexpected things that happen to companies on a daily basis. And I think that's about diversity. So we're seeing a lot more stuff. And I think that's pretty exciting. But I think there's a more complicated part to all this as well. And that is that, you know, I'm talking to you on an iPhone, my first Apple Macintosh I bought in 1985. I paid £2,400 for it. And I could have bought a good family saloon car for that, as my wife reminded me quite often at the time. I've just bought a latest iPad, which is now the fastest computer in my house. And I paid The money I paid for it was what I paid for a set of tyres for the car. So technology prices have tumbled. I think everything that technology has touched has got a lot cheaper. I mean, I saw it in Alistair the other day. They were selling USB keyboards for £5, and they're selling USB mice for less than £5. They're £2.50. You know, these are spectacularly cheap prices. And the cost of booking, you know, we were talking about skiing briefly earlier. I mentioned it because we've just been booking a skiing holiday. You know, you're just going to Google around the forums, find somebody who's got an apartment they want to rent. You have a quick look at the video, you talk to them directly, you book it up. You know, whereas 15 years ago, you'd have gone to a company would have done all the work for you, they'd have paid a rep to look after you when you got there. It would have all been very expensive. The real cost of that holiday is probably hard. But education hasn't got cheaper, and there's a reason for that, and the reason is, although we've thrown technology and education in quite a large amount, we've insisted that kids still do what they used to do without technology, and then we give them technology and we say, would you mind carrying on doing it for this time? It's a bit like, you know, if you were used to walking to school, and then somebody finally invents a bicycle, they give you a bicycle, but the school insists that you walk to school carrying the bicycle. You know, you don't really see an improvement. It's only when you're allowed to get on the bike and do what you couldn't do before.
Oh, bang. We just seem to have lost our connection there, folks. I don't know whether David will get back. I'm just going to ring him and see. Oh, connection lost again. So hopefully in a wee minute or two, folks, we'll be able to bring David and Stephen. Here we are, there's a ring.
It's just a bit inconvenient, isn't it? Like, you put the blinds up, it's a bit of daylight, and you carry where I talk. So we're still doing this strange version of maths in school with these technology freelance. And I'm not sure what it prepares anybody for at all. And I think we're going to see the real gains in the curriculum when people say, I'll tell you what, what's the curriculum we could never have done if we didn't have Tony? And when we look at the research, the research often says that, you know, let's find kids doing geography, right? Let's find kids doing geography with a computer, let's compare. And, well, we didn't have a huge gain from them doing, you know, it wasn't a great gain from them doing geography with it. But let's find something you can only do with a computer, and let's see how well the kids do without a computer, and you would get infinite gain, because they can't do it at all without a computer. Oh, my trends on the right, right there, in a rather exciting way. So I think I'm going to get on it. but that's all right. This is all sorry. You're still there, Jackson.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah, good. So I'm on the train. So, you know, in any way, the training is, once again, is a nice illustration. You know, if people used to walk along this route years ago, you know, if we'd have restricted the trains to only going at walking paces, you know, what we did with cars originally, do you remember we made people, you know, walk along with a red flag in front of the car to limit how fast they can go? I think the curriculum's a bit like the man with the red flag, you know, saying, well, you can't go any faster than this. And actually, I think kids can go a lot faster, and they can do things they couldn't dream of before. And it's only when they embrace those things will we really see the gains. There'll be no possible for all this.
Hopefully you're okay to sit with us for a little longer, Stephen.
Yeah, no, I think the way the trains are looking, you'd probably be until about 3 a.m.
I hope you get to where you intend to today at a reasonable time. I'm thinking about we haven't really spoken about the state of education in England, and I don't know if you want to say something kind of generally about that, but I'm thinking back to what you said earlier about this, I suppose, state-sponsored, state-funded educational revolution, which started in the last recession in Australia. I'm just wondering how, well, I was going to ask about how sustainable that is when maybe technologies need to be, learning spaces need to be upgraded, but what I'm most interested in is, you know, from where I'm standing as a full-time class teacher in Scotland with a new curriculum and new exams to deal with, and also a profession that feels as if, certainly in some quarters, feels that they're under a bit of attack, whether that is you know, more accountability, things like, you know, re-registration, which is going to be called something other than that, but teachers feel it's re-registration, and also calls in a recent government report for more experts and more people from the community to take a role in class teaching. It sounds as if this is not helping any early moves towards redefining learning spaces with much more, you know, young people in it, and different activities and breakouts, and lots of staff actually collaborating in the same space. So it's working elsewhere, but are we seeing it at all in the UK?
I was in the school the other day, and I won't tell you the name of the school, but it's a school that was hugely successful with its kids passing exams. And I was in there to advise them about making some changes. And, you know, I spent a lot of time walking around. I never saw a kid smile in the room at all. I only saw them smile when they left the rooms. And it was a proper exam, and a very good one. You know, the kids were taught everything they needed to know. Every class had a teacher doing a stand and deliver, you know, telling the kids everything they needed, but it was done. But, you know, when we started looking at what had happened to those kids when they left, it was pretty depressing. A lot of them struggled at university because they'd been so spoon-fed that they didn't have the independence of thought to be able to move forward. So that model of learning had got them as far as it could go in the school system, but was actually doing them a great disservice in terms of their employment, in terms of their university life. And although they were some of the brightest kids I've met for a long time, I mean, very few of them are going on to get first class degrees and going on to be captains of industry and going on to be political leaders, because they just didn't know how to do it left to their own devices. And I think, you know, there's a complex algorithm here about what successful education looks like, and it's more than the exam part is a flipping point. It's also the ability to bolt down the job with a bit independent learner, good parent, and all those other things. And I think all that lot actually matters. But when you come to the learning spaces, again, I think, you know, the kids are diverse, and you know, they know that kids like to learn standing up. They like to learn. You know, there's lots of kids in Scotland who would read a book sitting in an upright chair when they're on holiday. And you don't see them picking up chairs in the breakfast room and taking them down to the beach because they want to read a novel. You know, they read slumped out, lying down, and, you know, and in schools we make them sit on these glassed upright chairs, and then we wonder why we've got a reading crisis. You know, some of this is just good, obvious common sense. But, you know, how many companies in Scotland do you walk to the door and everybody's sitting in the room facing the same direction in identical chairs? The answer is none. But there was a time when that was not like that. You know, you'd go into a typing pool, you'd go into a factory, and the time a motion person had everybody a meter apart doing identical jobs. But those days have gone, and they haven't gone in some of our schools. And I just don't know what those schools are preparing children for. And I think they're robbing children of their future, and I'll put it that strongly.
Sorry, Stephen.
So we're coming into about, I think, about the last 10 minutes or so of tonight's show. John, I'm just going to ask you to get him in a little moment, but again, relating maybe my final question here, Stephen, in relation to the so-called education revolution in Australia. You know, that happened, that kind of level of funding, that was some years ago now, and clearly, you know, you can show how that has made such an important change, sustained Australia's economy in a difficult time, and also led to big changes in terms of the way schools operate and children learn day to day. Has the UK missed the boat in terms of that approach? What was that? You know, was that a different era? I appreciate it wasn't that long ago. But is this kind of approach something that you still advocate in the UK?
I don't think any countries are doing well or badly. I mean, I think a lot of individual schools are. And within individual schools, you see the central distance. I think the model has inverted. And I think 20 years ago, you know, the government told people what to do. Head teachers interpreted it. But they're seeing a manager team to... it's coming from... swapped great ideas to each other, can't wait to try them out. They've been given license by imaginative senior management team who will say, I'll tell you what, you guys try getting phones out and using them and you see what the others are doing so you know it's safe. And if it works for you, we'll pass those bits of information on to the school, we'll copy it. So, you know, the model has inverted, and I think the head teacher now stands at the base of all this. You know, with a huge ambition. The head teacher's job is that vision and ambition, and say, tell you what, you know, we can have the smartest kids in Northwest Europe, let's go for it. Whereas before, they were saying, here's what we're going to do, let's go for it. Now they're setting the vision and the ambition. And I think good ministers are doing the same thing as well. I mean, gosh, look at the changes going on in Wales at the moment, which I think are really interesting. Or down in Tasmania, putting up the first green education minister. I think those ministers aren't saying this is what you do. They're saying this is how great you want me to be. This is how ambitious you want to be. And the teachers, the learning professionals, who, goodness knows, you know, if you stand in the school where else you find that many graduates focused on anything as complex as learning in the community, schools are these intellectual powerhouses in our community. And I think smart teachers and smart ministers are just saying, come on, let's go for it. Let's do what we can. And let's be scholars and let's be professional and let's find out how good our kids might be. And I think that model's going there. So I don't see, you know, I see places like Singapore, they're saying, you know, let's teach less so we might learn more. And places like Hong Kong, you know, whereas they said, learning to learn is the mantra. But what I really see in terms of progress are individual schools doing really good things with great teachers. So I know the UK hasn't lost out. We have the advantage of diversity. The great thing about having Scotland, England, Wales, and the Channel Islands and the Northern Ireland is we can try out, we can rapid prototype and try out ideas and see what works. All we've got to make sure we do is pass them around to each other and all sort of swap the good ideas and swap what works. And I think if we do that well, that's great. But if we lock ourselves away and say we're not going to talk to the Welsh because they're adopting Facebook, and then we aren't going to talk to the Scots because we're putting up student fees, you know, let's see what happens when we put up student fees, and that's what happens when we don't, and let's learn from those different instances, and that's the only way we're going to go fast enough.
Hey, Stephen.
I'm actually sitting on a train that's going quite as slow as it's talking about going fast. Seems to be slightly spurious, but I don't think I'm ever going to get anywhere tonight. This has all been a nice conversation, really. And I think I'm going to have to focus now and try and work how to get the Hull. Stevenage. So if I just got Google in front of them, Stevenage to Hull is looking like not a trivial journey to me. So, well, folks, wish me luck. And as I said at the beginning, you know, the world we're in is the world of the most unexpected things, and we've got to know how to cope with them. And that's my challenge, I think, for this.
Well, listen, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. It's not been ideal conditions for us. We've been very lucky with the people who have appeared on the media this year, and we're very grateful to each and every one of them. Some of the ideas and the experiences that you're sharing, Stephen, are so inspirational, and you know, it's situated in real life and real school. It will certainly be, you know, be helpful to everybody in their own way, all of the listeners to the Radio Edu Talk. So, thank you very much. If we get any feedback or any questions, I'm sure, you know, we can forward them on to you.
And of course, I'm at Stephen Hetzel on Twitter, so if people want to tweet me to cheer me up on the journey, I'd be Stephen Hetzel, so yeah, send me a few tweets and I'll let you know if I ever get help.
Okay, thanks again, Stephen. Take care, and I hope you
bye. Cheers, bye.
Bye now.
Cheers.